The following program comes to you as part of the Africa Health Network, a service of the Voice of America to our audience throughout the African continent.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lino Mudu, and welcome to Health Chat. Every day, men, women, and children from around the world immigrate in the United States voluntarily or in seek of refuge. As they settle in various communities, they are confronted with some basic needs, including access to health care. On today's show, we will discuss community health care and particularly the care of immigrant populations. Joining us here in the studio is Vienna Mbagaya, an epidemiologist and the executive director of Vienna Nairobi, a public health consulting firm that focuses on global health, health disparity, and women's health, as well as immigration health. Ms. Mbagaya, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lenora. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here. Also joining us via phone this time from Baltimore, Maryland, is registered nurse Catherine Bissett. Ms. Bissett is a nurse at Day Spring Community Programs in Baltimore. Ms. Bissett, welcome to the program. Hello, Catherine Bissett, are you there?
How are you?
Hi, it's good to hear from you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Let me remind our listeners, if you'd like to participate in the show with your question or comment, you can call 202-619-3111. The U.S. country code is 1 and ask your international operator to reverse the charges. You can also email us your thoughts at healthchat@voanews.com or post your questions or comments at facebook.com/voahealthchat. We will discuss community healthcare in a moment, but first, here is a report by VOA's R. Chimes.
Health policy experts classify immigrants as a vulnerable group at increased risk for health problems and inadequate health care. The health vulnerability of immigrants is the subject of a paper in the issue of Health Affairs, a journal that examines health policy issues. Lead author Catherine DeRose of the RAND Corporation in California says some factors like low income or limited education can make anyone vulnerable, but immigrants, she said, have some special risks.
Things like their immigration status, whether they're, you know, a citizen or not, naturalized citizen or a legal permanent resident versus an undocumented, when they came to this country because policies have been changing, where they live in this country can also seem to affect how good their access to care and quality of care is.
There is evidence that immigrants, at least the young ones who come here to work, actually are healthier than their American-born counterparts, at least when they arrive. Over time, however, their health deteriorates. Study co-author Nicole Lurie saw that firsthand when she lived in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Minneapolis has had a lot of different immigrant populations over the years. First, lots of South Asians, Vietnamese, and Hmong communities, and then more recently, a huge Somali influx. When I first started taking care of Somali patients, you never saw a Somali person who was diabetic. Now, something like half of Somalis in that community are diabetic because they've adopted really crummy American Western health habits.
Immigrants are a pretty diverse group that includes naturalized citizens and both legal and undocumented non-citizens. Their legal status, in fact, plays a big role in their health status, say the authors, because their legal status may limit their access to various government services or to jobs with health-related benefits. The recent increase in anti-immigrant sentiment, the authors suggest, may result in more limitations. In their jobs, immigrants may be engineers or child care providers or farm workers, and they come from almost every country on earth. Their socioeconomic status, too, is an important factor in how healthy they are and how well they're treated when they get sick. Income, education, and English proficiency are also part of the mix. For example, Spanish speakers are more likely to find a Spanish-speaking doctor in Los Angeles or Dallas than in a small town in Idaho or Maine, far from the Mexican border. Among these various risk factors, one seems missing, the country of origin. In fact, co-author Nicole Lurie stresses that their diversity makes it hard to generalize about the health vulnerability of immigrants from any one country.
But I also suspect that what we're going to find is that where immigrants go is also going to have a lot to do with how they do. So if people, regardless of where they come from, end up in places where there are good school systems and their kids can get educated and they can learn English and there are job opportunities, they're going to do better than people who aren't.
One recommendation the authors make is to expand access to health insurance, whether through private providers or through government programs. This is Art Chimes reporting.
And let me start with you, Ms. Mbagaya Viena. I will call you Viena for the show, if you allow me.
Yeah, of course.
Sure, it will make for a good conversation. Listen, Viena, when you heard the package and Art Chimes just went over many different issues with regards to immigrants' health, why is it in general important to focus on immigrants' health, not just as, you know, part of the general population, but specifically because they are immigrants? Why is it important to do so?
Well, when it comes to a migrant community, they're moving from a place where they've called home to a place where they don't call home and they're trying to make it a home. Mm-hmm. Part of making a new environment home is feeling safe and feeling healthy. And so we have to empower the people that are coming into this country and give them tools, not just adults, but also youth and children. Give them tools to navigate the healthcare system and give them tools where they can actually combat the same issues Americans are facing. So if you come to this country and you're not obese, then it's actually it would be great to have the intervention early, so you know in this country you're exposed to a lot of food, a lot of different food, and some of it may not be healthy. So these are the tools you use to make sure you don't encounter the same problems Americans encounter. So it's very, very specific and very sensitive to a group that's making that is assimilating, that's making an environment their home.
Okay, Ms. Bissett, you heard the report. The study was conducted a couple of years ago, but a lot of it, if not all of it, is very true today when you look at the immigrant population. In your practice as a nurse, what are some of the issues that you find very frequently when you welcome immigrants in your clinic?
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Some of the data shows that immigrants, when they first arrive in the United States, actually are healthier than native-born Americans, regardless of their country of origin. So we call this phenomenon health selection, that immigrants tend to be healthier than an average person in their sending country. We're basically assuming that the people who choose to migrate to another country are among the healthiest. So they're showing lower rates of cancer, lower rates of heart disease and of lung disease than we see in the American population. But then very quickly after they arrive in our country, they seem to fall prey to the same diseases that lower SES demographic people in our country face, which are, as your other guests mentioned, obesity and then subsequently diabetes, hypertension, as well as an onset of mental health problems as well, such as depression and anxiety.
Okay, and we'll talk more about the mental health aspect, but why do they come across these health issues that some of the population here in the United States have, the low-income population, as you mentioned? Does it have just to do with diet? Because I know that some people, and I'm an immigrant myself, when I first moved here, I was not eating, you know, fast food right away or anything. I'm still not quite eating that. But what are some of the other reasons besides the diet?
Yeah, well, a lot of it has to do with the areas they're living in, right? So they, the geography of their neighborhoods, the access to good quality food sources, good grocery stores. But in addition to the diet, I find the most interesting factor is that we're finding that stress and long-term stress, the stress of being an immigrant, the stress of discrimination against them from different, from schools, from providers, from landlords, from employers, that stress has a very negative effect on health. So not only can that cause mental health problems, it actually causes things like hypertension. Mm-hmm. You may have heard of the stress hormone cortisol. Long-term exposure to that stress hormone cortisol causes things like diabetes and heart disease. So we see that the less of a community that immigrants are part of, the fewer support systems they have, the less access to good translation, the higher their levels of stress are. And that can lead to real health impacts.
And Viena, as an immigrant yourself, mm-hmm. what was your experience with regards to access to healthcare or your personal health when you moved here? Did you see a change right away?
Oh, yeah. And actually, I moved here at a very prime time. I was about 13, so puberty. And I came from a place where, in my situation, I lived in poverty and I didn't have access to food and all the things that I saw when I came to this country. So when I landed, the first thing I did was start eating.
Okay.
I started eating right away. Couldn't believe it. And, you know, to be honest, at that age, no matter what you do, you are going to, you're developing, your body's developing. So I saw the changes right away. And I think as the other guest has mentioned, you'll notice that it's exposure. If you're exposed to certain foods or even certain water or even certain just air pollution or whatever, whatever you're exposed to, you become it. So immigrants, when they come here, it's not like they want to maintain their culture and separate from everyone else. They do want to be part of the community. So they end up actually adapting to the American lifestyle. And it may take time to catch up to the American, I guess, health quality. But the point is, when they come here, they do want to be part of the community. So they are going to participate in the same activities. They're going to go to the same restaurants. They're going to go to the same schools, the same vacations, the same everything Americans do. And part of that is having exposure to the food and to the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But did you want to react to that, Ms. Bissett?
I was just going to say, I think it's really interesting. There was one study done in California around Japanese immigrants, and it showed that the Japanese immigrants who stayed closest to their traditional Japanese culture, who didn't learn English that well, who worked mainly with other Japanese people, who went to schools where it was mainly Japanese students, those were the healthiest. The Japanese that acculturated more or involved themselves more with Americans, worked with Americans, those people, their incidence of congestive heart failure was much higher than those Japanese who stayed very isolated within their immigrant community. So the data's there.
Okay. But it is true when we talk about Western diet, and it tends, we have this tendency to think, or at least some reports have shown, mm-hmm. that it can lead to diseases like diabetes, non-communicable diseases. But in the end, I think that there is also a question of choices. You know, these immigrants, mm-hmm. we as immigrants have mm-hmm. the choices to make. Mm-hmm. We don't have to eat a at the fast food restaurant if we don't want to. So what is, I want to think that it's not necessarily that the American diet is bad in general. There is mm-hmm. good and there is bad, but it's about choices. What is your reaction to that, Vienna?
So when you say choices, I think of barriers to those choices. Mm-hmm. And as yeah, and I think of a socioeconomic status, for example.
Okay.
So if you live in a neighborhood where every other corner is a fast food place, one, it's convenient. Number two, is cheap. And part of it's just part of the experience. You know, so I can come in and say, yeah, I'm going to go to McDonald's, but I won't order the... You know, I don't eat fast food either. I'm like you, I'm classy.
Oh my goodness, okay.
But, you know, I'm not going to order the burger, but instead I'll get a salad.
Yes.
You know, but anybody can do that. Yes. Americans can do that. They can make that choice, but some of them don't. A lot of them don't, and that's why we have the issues that we do. So immigrants are just like anyone else. When they come here, it's about the environment you're in. It's about what you can afford, mm-hmm. you know, and it's also about, you know, do you have the opportunity to do all that stuff? Do you have the opportunity to go to Whole Foods? Some people will never see a Whole Foods in their neighborhood, let alone go to one somewhere else.
True.
Yeah, so it's about exposure and where you are when you land, when you get here.
I think we also assume that if people, this is not even speaking to undocumented immigrants, but say we have legal immigrants who are receiving services now, who are maybe getting food stamps, what we call the SNAP program. Some of the families that I work with who are on SNAP benefits receive less than $300 a month for a family of three. So you're feeding a mom and two kids maybe on about, you know, $45, $50 a week. So even if you do have a good quality grocery store at your disposal that you can get to without an hour-long bus ride, making that money stretch and getting enough calories into your children is a challenge. So many people take advantage of free and reduced lunches and free breakfasts at public schools, which seems like a great benefit, right, to our low-income children. Mm-hmm. The quality of the food that these children are receiving in our public schools is really abhorrent. It's very carbohydrate-heavy, very few fruits and vegetables, and now we're working on it. The city of Baltimore has a great new initiative with a salad bar in every public elementary school, but doing education with kids on what their plate should look like, how much fruits and vegetables should be there versus how much pizza is a challenge. So it's on all of us, teachers, nurses, every community members, to be modeling to our kids what their food intake should look like.
Okay, and I wanted to talk about something you mentioned earlier, Ms. Bissett. You talked about the stress level of immigrants and how access to mental health services can be challenging. Can you elaborate a little more on that?
Sure. So it's hard to pinpoint the etiology of mental health problems in immigrants, right? We don't know what their experience has been in their home country, in their sending country, what trauma they've experienced, why they're immigrating in the first place. The process of immigration is hugely stressful. And then when they get here, they're oftentimes living in unsafe neighborhoods, isolated, not a lot of access to translation. So you can imagine the incredible variety of stressful experiences they have on a daily basis. Getting mental health care for low-income native-born Americans is a huge challenge. My clients wait on average 3 months to get in to see a therapist or a psychiatrist, let alone finding an equipped mental health care provider that has translation services. So there's the issue of language. There's the issue of finding a translator who's equipped to translate therapy, which is a whole another sort of nuanced kind of language, right? Some some words that we use in English don't exist in other languages. The concepts don't exist.
That's true.
So it's a huge barrier for them. Also, people don't have the same cultural views of depression, what the American lexicon is surrounding mental illness and surrounding our sort of comfort with taking psychiatric medicine doesn't exist in a lot of developing countries. So I find huge resistance to the idea that one would take a pill to make someone feel better mentally.
Very important. And Vienna, I see you nodding.
Yeah. Oh, so you were, Ms. Bissett, you were just coming closer and closer and closer to what I was thinking. And one was, we need to be talking to the immigrants and asking them before we can provide services. I mean, we can provide services, but if it's not sensitive to their needs, it's not effective. That's one. And number two, the stigma around mental health is not just within the immigrant population. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You
yes.
know, in my work in military health, a lot of military folk don't even want to be seen going to a mental health clinic because the command has to find out and everyone has to know. And their records are not private. And there are other barriers to that, too, besides the stigma. Mm-hmm. And also in my work in HIV, you find the same thing. A lot of people don't even want to say the word, even when they're positive. They don't want to take the medication because of the stigma that is attached to it. So imagine somebody coming from a very conservative culture where you are told if you have a mental breakdown, it's because you're weak. If you seek help, it's because you're even weaker. And, you know, it's not okay to share your problems. You shouldn't even have those problems. You should be mentally strong enough to combat that. So when we don't have room in our culture to talk about mental health and to talk about seeking help and eliminating that stigma, it's next to impossible to actually maintain a healthy lifestyle when you're here and you're going through all the stresses that we mentioned.
Very good point. You mentioning culture and how it does impact the way we access services or the way we take care of ourselves.
Exactly.
And that's one of the area of focus for you, especially when it comes to the youth.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to talk about that when we come back. We have to take a short break. And when we return, we'll have more on immigrants' health. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight's topic on Health Chat is community health care with an emphasis on immigrant health. Joining us in the studio is Vienna Mbagaya, Executive Director of Vienna Nairobi, a public health consulting firm. And via phone from Baltimore, Maryland, is registered nurse Catherine Bissett. A reminder that you can join our conversation by emailing us at healthchat@voanews.com or calling 202-619-3111. And I do have a question here from Kwesi in Ghana. He says, how does HIV/AIDS affect the African immigrants in the United States? Vienna, I know you work in the field of HIV as well. Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea of the impact? Because when we look at the statistics, we hear that we know, at least that's what we know, is that HIV affects Africa, one of the most affected continent. Mm-hmm. How about Africans in the United States?
So when you look at just the data on HIV incidence, which is new cases, in the U.S., the fastest growing group is African-American women. Right. And just in Washington, D.C., the rates of HIV are similar to the ones in the rates in sub-Saharan Africa. So when you look at the African population here, you'll find the same issues you find in any other population. There's a lot of stigma attached to it. Well, you've seen people get kicked out of their homes. Mm-hmm. You've seen people get, you know, lose their jobs, lose their support system because HIV is by the way it's contracted. There's an issue there.
Yeah, you one of the
had,
ways. Yeah,
yes, you had sexual. Unprotected sex, mm-hmm. or you had, you know, exposure to drugs, or you've done something wrong for you to be HIV positive. Mm-hmm. So in our culture, we don't have we don't provide the platform where we can talk about sex or sexuality openly, so that when somebody does encounter an STD or HIV, they're free to speak with their family first or whichever support system they have. And if you look at immigrants, a lot of immigrants come here. Sometimes they don't have their family here, so they have a support system of just their community and their extended family. And if that support system is not there, it's really difficult. So these are the same immigrants that they will know they're positive, that but they don't have the confidence or the support system to go and seek help and maintain the medication. HIV is something that can be maintained for a very long time. And all you have to do is take your medication and make sure your CD4 count is above that of AIDS. And so if you have someone who's not taking the medication, who's ashamed to go to the clinic, who's ashamed to talk about their status, and I understand the stigma, but if somebody is so sensitive and so ashamed, it makes it harder. So I think Africans or immigrants in general probably suffer more when they're diagnosed when they don't have the support system, which is harder to find when you're an immigrant here.
Okay, Ms. Bissett, do you see some similarities? You work a lot with the Hispanic community at your clinic. Do you see some similarities with what Vienna just mentioned?
I think yes. Well, it circles back to mental health once again, right? So we see untreated mental health being self-medicated, right? What we mean by that is when someone isn't getting the proper therapy or medication for depression and anxiety, they tend to go towards self-destructive behaviors like drinking and drug use and avoiding medical professionals because of some of that shame. Mm-hmm. So at what point are we catching these problems, right? If we oftentimes, new incidents of HIV occur because of unprotected sex that has been influenced by drinking or drug use, right? Bad choices oftentimes come when someone is incapacitated because they've been self-medicating for another problem, depression or anxiety. So at what point are we screening immigrants for these problems that we could address them before they develop into those self-medicating sort of negative behaviors? That's something we really need to look at other institutions outside of the clinic, because we don't get everyone that we need to see at the doctor, right? So we need to be catching people where they are. One interesting initiative in Baltimore is that you're familiar with the idea of a school nurse's office in a public school. Mm-hmm. Well, some of the public schools in Baltimore are now functioning as a family clinic, so that any relative of a student in a public school can be seen at the clinic in the school. So we're bringing healthcare to where parents might be already. When they drop off their kid, they can also run and get a pap smear. They can run in and get an HIV test. So that's the kind of initiatives we need to reach our more vulnerable populations, including immigrants. We also have a caravan here in Baltimore that parks in heavily Latino neighborhoods where people can just walk in and get care in this large sort of RV. So we need to diversify the way we're delivering care to reach more people and catch HIV positive people when it is in earlier stages.
Very interesting. And I see you nodding again.
No, I'm laughing because that used to be my job. One of my first jobs in grad school, out of grad school, was being in that clinic van and going to high-risk places in Washington, D.C. And at that time, it was MSM, which is Men Who Have Sex With Men. And it was also women's high-risk women and heterosexual populations, and also IDU, intravenous drug users. So we'd park the van and come out and just talk to, you know, people walking by and talk to them about getting tested. And we'd have incentives, of course, monetary incentives, and it was for studies. So I've seen that in Baltimore, New York, in a lot of cities here as well. And the good thing about it is, like, yes, we are going to them, we're meeting them where they are, and that's part of the battle. That's half the battle, just making sure they know you're there and also making sure you know where they are. But part of the challenge is also being seen. That used to be my one of our barriers. Somebody doesn't want to be seen next to the HIV van.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. So sometimes you'd give them a card, slide them a card, and they can come to the campus or to the offices where they can get care, and they can get it in private.
Yes.
Yeah. A lot of times it's also the community is looking at me. I don't want to be seen as a person who stopped and went in the van or coming out of the van. What if they think I have something? So
it's that issue of stigma again.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very... It's a critical problem, and it's not just with HIV/AIDS, but other issues, as you mentioned, Ms. B said, with mental health and everything else. So many other conditions that stigma is really not helping to address. Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted you to talk about, Vienna, to talk about what you're doing with the youth, because it's something so critical. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, not to generalize, but when it comes to Africans, we know where we come from, we know our culture, and a lot of it, we do not talk about sex and sexual health to your elders, to your parents. Now, that's something that you seek to address, helping youth talk to their parents or, you know, in a way so they can get help with sexual health. Tell us more about that and why it's so critical.
So I have this website, theinvisibleneighbors.com, and there I just collect stories of immigrants and first-generation Americans and tell our story from my own perspective. And part of the initiative to market the website and the campaign itself is to go from colleges to high schools and talk to immigrant students about their health, about sexuality, about everything that they may not feel comfortable talking to their parents about. And this is not just for me to listen to kids, but it's also to transfer the knowledge to the parents. Because parents, you know, like you were saying before, we have a very proud culture that we want to maintain no matter where we are. So you can tell your kids, you don't have sex, don't mess with boys, don't get a girl pregnant. You can have all these rules, but you're not giving them tools to actually combat the real world. Mm-hmm. So when they step out into the world, they're experiencing something totally different. If you turn on the TV right now, it could be network TV at 8 p.m. prime time, and you'll see so much gratuitous sex and violence that it's just, there's no reason why you should be there at that age. I mean, at that time. But you have kids of immigrants, a lot of immigrants work a lot. So you have your kids, you know, at home watching television, and they're getting these messages, but they're not getting the context.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, don't get a girl pregnant, you talk about condom negotiation. As a woman, what do you say about condom use? How do you protect yourself when you're with a man? And these are young girls that are experiencing this in schools, but nobody talks to them at home about it.
Yes,
or talk to boys about, you know, what it means first about consent, right? And also about, you know, just sexual health itself. I want to create a platform where I can kind of pass the message on to parents and tell them, listen, it's great that you're teaching your kids what you learned about your culture and everything, but it's also very important that you listen to them because they are coming from a very different generation, a very different, they have different, very different exposures to what we never knew about.
Okay. You know? Very, very good. Ms. Bissette, we're going to have to leave it there, Vienna. Ms. Bissette, thank you so much for joining us from Baltimore, sharing your experience with us.
Thanks for having me.
It was great to have you. Vienna Mbagaya, thank you for being in the studio with us.
Thank you, Lenora. Thank you.
And that was Vienna Mbagaya and Catherine Bissett joining us for the conversation today. I thank all of you for listening to our program. For more on today's topic, log on to our website at voanews.com. Keep the conversation going on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenora Mudo in Washington with producer Jackson Bunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.